Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
So we were looking very much forward to coming here to Georgetown and especially to see the buildings, the tour of the campus. And it reminded me of what Winston Churchill observed. He said, "We build our buildings, and our buildings build us." So you think of some of the most beautiful buildings on this campus, right? What do? They build you. In what way great expense was taken for these buildings, right? And they build you. How do they build you? They build you interiorly. They give you a sense of who you are, a sense of your own dignity, a sense of the greatness to which you were called, right? There's a majesty, a stateliness about these buildings. But isn't this also true, what Winston Churchill said? We build our buildings, and our buildings build us. Isn't this also true of the interior architecture that we create through our memory and our imaginations? And through what we choose to read, what we choose to watch, who we choose to talk to about what. So I think we can ask ourselves, what are the interior libraries, living rooms, bars, shopping plazas, prisons, concentration camps, and cathedrals that we've built in our own imaginations? Because they tell us something of who we are. So we're here tonight to talk about the project of literature. And literature has very much to do with these interior edifices. And as I hope I've begun to already suggest, you can see that literature is not a mere artifact of culture. It's actually a driving force of culture. And think about this word culture, right? It's a beautiful word, culture. At the heart of the word culture is the word cult. Okay, now don't think creepy cult, okay? But think of the original sense, cultus, right? What we worship, what we value, what we hold dear. This is what is at the heart of culture. And you can think immediately, perhaps, of the word cultivate. So what is it that we cultivate? What do we tend? What do we sow? What do we reap in the fields of our hearts? Is it spiny, thorny things? Gossip, envy, lust, judgment, criticism? And what does that give to others? Pain and ugliness. Or do we sow wheat and flowers? Goodness, compassion, tenderness, generosity, forgiveness, patience. Giving beauty and nourishment to others. Giving laughter and joy. So what we tend and what we reap in the field of our hearts makes a difference. These interior edifices that we build with our memories and our imaginations make a difference. So what is the project of literature? Well, all truly great literature seeks to answer one question. And what is that one question? What does it mean to be human? What does it mean to be human? So the best of literature will answer for us the perennial questions that Plato posed. What does it mean to be noble, to be just, to be good, to be honorable? Now, Aristotle, in his Rhetoric and his Poetics, and then Cicero, the great rhetorician, they spoke of rhetoric as having three aims. The rhetorician, for us, great literature, has three aims. What are those three aims? First, to instruct, right? This element, logos. What is the reason? What is the philosophy? What is the argument behind the piece of literature? So that's the first purpose, to instruct, right? With the logos, that element of logos. And then the second purpose of literature is to delight, right? Otherwise, nobody would be reading it. So we need something that takes us out of our ordinary world, right? A friend of mine put it this way. He said, literature allows us to inhabit many worlds simultaneously, right? And then we can draw upon those many worlds we're inhabiting to know how to better live in this world. Okay, so to delight. This is the ethos, right? The spirit, the character of the work that carries us along. And then, so to instruct, logos, to delight, ethos, and then the third purpose of the rhetorician of great literature is to move or to inspire. And the Hebrews, in fact, would consider this the most important part of these three aims of literature. Pathos, why? Because the heart, right, the feeling, what will you be moved and inspired by? So there's a twofold aspect to this pathos. First, the attraction to the good. Okay, the attraction to the good, and then the repulsion toward evil. Now, I don't know if this has been spoken about too much, but what is the literature of today? The literature of today, we find it in movies, we find it in television series, and, you know, all these millions of episodes of things in Netflix shows, right? In YouTube things, in music. Okay, so among some of the popular movies out right now, well, this is an older movie, but do you remember Captain America, the first Avenger? And the sergeant is totally against the skinny guy, right? He does not want him to be the one chosen. He's got this other guy in mind, right? This big, tough guy. And then the little skinny guy, when he says, so the sergeant, remember this? He takes the grenade out. They're in the middle of doing their jumping jacks, and the asthmatic skinny guy is like, he's barely making it, right? But the sergeant takes a live, he says, he takes a grenade out of the back of a truck or something, and he throws it in the middle of the guys doing all the jumping jacks, and he says, live grenade, right? And then everybody ducks. But the little skinny guy, who's the future Captain America, do you remember this? Mm-hmm. He jumps on top of the grenade, right? Because he's going to use his body to muffle the effect of the grenade on everybody else, right? And he says, get back, get back. He tells everybody else to get back. And this is the moment that we see what heroism is, right? Self-sacrifice. And it's wonderful because he shows us the itinerary also of a man, right? That a man, when he's a boy, his focus is on self-preservation, right? I got to get the biggest piece of cake. I got to get the biggest piece of pizza. I got to be first in line for water, right? It's self-preservation. But what's the natural itinerary that a man follows? From self-preservation to self-sacrifice. And this is what we see, right? And then you learn that this special serum that's going to make him Captain America is going to magnify his natural qualities. So this natural quality, where his immediate instinct is to sacrifice himself, that's going to be magnified, right? So there's a teaching there on virtue. And so what happens in the heart of the young boy who watches this? His heart is inspired toward the good. Okay, so that's the first aspect of this pathos. What's the second aspect? Because you need both. The repulsion for evil. Okay, now this is what's unfortunate, is that the Disney versions of fairy tales have in fact impoverished them. The original stories, whether in Hans Christian Andersen or the Brothers Grimm, when you look at the original tales, there was a lot more gore. And the gore was instructive. Okay, so in the original Cinderella, the two ugly stepsisters, remember they were trying to put on the glass slipper. So same basic story, okay, but they're trying to put on the glass slipper. And when one of the sisters, actually in the original tale, the sisters were not ugly, okay? It's almost too pat, easy to read, ugly equals evil. No, these sisters were actually beautiful, okay, also. What the first one does is to fit her foot into the glass slipper, she cuts off her toes. I mean, I don't know why. Kid could ask, but mom, couldn't he see through the glass slipper? Maybe he was being modest and didn't look at her feet. So anyway, so she cuts off her toes to put on the glass slipper. Look, it fits. And then she gets in the carriage to leave, and he's like, this is my bride. I'm going to marry her. And then the carriage is going off, and then there's a crow or something in the tree that says, there's blood on the trail. There's blood on the trail. And so the prince is like, no, you are not it. So he goes back, right? And then the other stepsister tries to fit her foot in the glass slipper, and she cuts her heel off. And then the same thing repeats. There's blood on the trail. There's blood on the trail. And then finally he comes back and he gets Cinderella. Right? So this, yeah, something interesting going on there, right? Now, the one that really kills me, and actually, tomorrow there's going to be a seminar, and this is in the reading packet. So Paul has it. He can send it to you. This is a fabulous thing for you to read. The original version of The Little Mermaid and Hans Christian Andersen, translated by Jean Hersholtz. Okay? It's a fantastic translation. And Okay, now see, the Disney version is terrible. Because in the Disney version, she gets the prince. In the original version, she does not get the prince. Why? Because part of the story is trying to say, you cannot become what you are not, right? She's made to be a mermaid. She has a beautiful voice, but she wants to be human. She wants to participate in human love, but that's not for her. And so what's supposed to happen to her when she doesn't get the prince to fall in love with her and marry her, she's supposed to turn into seafoam. So if you read the original version, you'll see what happens when at the end, she doesn't get the prince to fall in love with her. And the sun is rising, and at sunrise is when she's supposed to turn into seafoam. She's going to receive a consequence, but there's something lovely there. And it's much richer than the Disney version, which says you can do anything you want. You can become anything you want, which is crazy. It's not true. It's not preparing children for reality, right? As future parents, some of you in this room, I think you're thinking about that. How will I form the moral imagination of my child? To love what is good and to hate what is evil. So if we look at these three aims of literature, logos, ethos, pathos, to instruct, to delight, to inspire, what are all of these employed for? They're employed to one end. That end is the shaping of the moral imagination. The shaping of the moral imagination. So think about that. How have we allowed our moral imaginations to be shaped? Thanks for coming. We're glad you had the courage to come in, because sometimes people just give up when they see the door shut. So thank you for coming. Okay, we're talking about the shaping of the moral imagination. You've actually come in at a perfect time. So here's this Thomistic principle, okay? This is a Thomistic principle. That before you can carry out an action, you have to conceive of it in your imagination. Does that make sense? Before you can carry out an action, you have to conceive of it in your imagination. Okay, I want to go to the talk tonight. So, okay, then I got to, oh, I can't do this, which is what I normally do. I'm going to do this instead. Oh, I got to cover this. Right? Does that make sense? Or if you're going to surprise somebody, right? You're going to have a surprise birthday party or something. You got to figure that out, right? You've got to work the whole thing out in their imagination and who's going to be where at what time, etc. Or if you're the evil person, which nobody in this room is like that, you're going to try to figure out how to steal something, right? You've got to work it out in your imagination first. So, in other words, before we can be noble, just, honorable, heroic, pure, what do we need? We need portraits. We need people inhabiting worlds and circumstances who show us in their world, in their circumstances, how to be just, how to be honorable, how to be pure, how to be heroic. I don't know about you all. Has anyone in here ever read Laura Ingalls Wilder, Little House on the Prairie? Okay. All right. So, you know, believe it or not, I've only read these very recently because there were two sisters sitting next to me and they were talking about Farmer Boy. I said, that sounds really good. And so over the past 5 years, I've just read all the Laura Ingalls Wilder books I could get my hands on. So this Little House on the Prairie, because I'd only been exposed to the television shows, which are terrible. I mean, terrible compared to the books. I mean, no offense. Okay. But there's something that you lose, I think, or something that didn't quite, yeah, that wasn't quite captured. So if you look at this little house on the prairie, right, where it's Ma, who's Caroline, Pa, who's Charles, and then the three girls, Mary, Laura, and Carrie, right? What is this little house on the prairie? If you zoom out, you realize this little house on the prairie is a home built on self-sacrifice, a home built on self-sacrificial love. I don't know if you remember in one of the books, I don't remember which one, but you know, Pa was the only guy. He was the only one who worked, right? And then the Ma and the daughters took care of the stuff in the household. But Pa was working out in the fields. And so he's got these boots, okay? And he's mended them 1,000 different times, okay? So they ended up having some extra money left over, $3 exactly. And so the girls are saying, Pa, we vote that you get new boots, okay? So he's like, okay, you're right. I've mended these to the nth degree. I better just get new boots. So he breaks down. And so he goes into town, right? And the girls have calculated how long it should take him before he returns, right? Because he's going to take the carriage and he's going to go in and he's going to come all the way back. So it's going to be a long journey, but he's going to come back with new boots. So they calculate. Pa comes home. He walks in. They look at his feet, of course. And guess what? He's got the same old boots. And they say, Pa, what happened? You were supposed to get new boots. And he said, you know, I got to the store, and guess who I ran into? Pastor Alden. And he wants to get a bell. He's trying to buy a new bell for the church. The church doesn't have a bell. And all he needed was $3. So I gave it to him. Right? But look at this. What's going on there? You have, again, that theme of self-sacrifice. But then also this theme of worship. Right? That he chose something to give glory to God over something for his own practical need. Another one of my favorite scenes is, okay, they're poor, but really they're rich, right? They're rich in the things that matter the most. So there's this one scene where Charles has got his really beat up, tattered coat, right? And then he's got his scarf and he's got, I think, his muff or whatever goes over his head, you know? And so there's Charles, and he's got to take this long journey, and it's super cold outside, below zero. And Ma is like tucking him in, right? You know, because there's always a little bit of love tucked in there. It keeps you warmer. So she's tucking him up. And she's, as she's trying to, you know, get his coat on, she says to him, oh, Charles, I wish you had a new coat. And Charles, what does he do? Laura is the one recounting this, right? She remembers this happening. Charles grabs Caroline and he kisses her, and he looks at her and he says, oh, Caroline, I wish you had diamonds. Mm-hmm. Right? So there's, you see this beautiful love, right, between Charles and Caroline that builds Laura. Okay. But one of my absolute favorites is On the Banks of Plum Creek. I don't know if you remember this one. So on the banks of Plum Creek, what happens? On the banks of Plum Creek, come on in. Don't be shy. We're just in the middle of a story, which shouldn't surprise you, because we're talking about the moral imagination. Okay, so we're talking about Laura Ingalls Wilder on the banks of Plum Creek, okay? So on the banks of Plum Creek, they're living in this house that's dug out. Can you imagine what a dugout house is? So imagine if this were a hill. I mean, kind of is. So you're on a hill, and what they basically have to do is they literally, out of the dirt, they dig the house out, okay? So Laura is enchanted by this dugout house. And the dugout house is like got one, it's got one main room, which is like their kitchen, and then Ma and Pa's bedroom. And then there's like a little ladder that leads up to a little loft. And in the little loft, that's where Laura and Mary sleep, okay? And so when they first get there, they're all settling in, all this kind of stuff. And then when they're all settled in, Pa says, okay, I'm going to take you all to the creek. Wow. Okay, so Laura's never lived by a creek before. And so when they go to play at the creek, she's like, she loves it. She's enchanted by it. So then they're leaving the creek, and Pa says, all right, girls, one very important rule. You may never go to the creek by yourselves. Or obviously, because it's dangerous, right? He's trying to protect them. You can never go to the creek by yourself. And so they're like, okay, Pa. Now, Ma, Mary are inside doing chores. Laura's finished hers, and so she's playing around outside. And she decides, I'm going to go to the creek. So she starts, like, going toward the creek. And then there's, like, this weird animal in the way. She, like, doesn't know what to do. She gets a stick, and she pokes at it. And it, like, makes some kind of weird noise at her. So she backs off. I can't go to the creek. So she's upset because she can't go to the creek. So they go home, and they're having dinner in the kitchen. And over dinner, Laura says, I ran into this weird animal. And she describes what the animal was like. And then Ma and Pa are like, sounds like a badger, Laura. She's like, okay. And then they do dishes, right, in the other part of the kitchen. And then Pa takes Laura and Mary upstairs, because Carrie sleeps downstairs with Mom and Dad. And Pa says prayers with Mary and Laura in the little loft and tucks them in. And it's kind of like now, right? It's getting dark outside. And Laura's finished saying her prayers, and she's sitting up in her bed under the covers. And it's on her mind that she was going to go to the creek. So she says, okay, I better go downstairs. Because she could hear Ma and Pa talking still at the table. I got to go down, and I got to ask Dad for a punishment. I got to ask Pa for my punishment. So here's little Laura. She climbs down the ladder. And she goes up to Pa. Okay, now Laura's still little. Okay, she's still little at this time. And Pa's sitting down and Ma's sitting there. And the light is just coming into the window just a little bit. She can't really see his face. Okay? And so she leans on her father's knee and says, Pa, you got to give me a punishment because I was going to go to the creek today and I'm not supposed to go to the creek. And so Pa is sitting there in the dark, you know, the light's becoming dark, and he's thinking about the punishment he should give to Laura. And you know what Laura writes of herself in this moment? She says, and Laura leaned on Pa's knee, and she could feel how strong and how kind he was. Isn't that gorgeous? She can't see his face. She's waiting for her punishment. But what does she feel? How strong. Isn't that gorgeous? Isn't that what you want to shape the moral imagination of your children? Right? This formation of conscience. Okay. So what I'd like to do, I've just finished talking about the project of literature in general, right? So the project of literature in general is to shape the moral... No, it happens to all of us, except for those of us who don't have phones. Okay, so... So, the project of literature is to shape the moral imagination, okay? That's the overarching. Now what I want to do, are you ready? I'm going to take you through classical literature, medieval literature, and modern literature in the next 3 hours, okay? So I hope you canceled all your... Just kidding. So that's what I want to do. But what we're going to do is we're only going to look at a sliver. So we're going to look at a sliver of classical literature, a sliver of medieval literature, then a sliver of modern literature, which is what we are going to apply to Tolstoy's Anna Karenina. You need to see Anna Karenina in context. And if you don't understand the slivers of classical literature and medieval literature to which he is referring in Anna Karenina, it won't make sense to you. So, okay, and I also have to, at this point, mention my indebtedness to the work of Dr. Louise Cowan, who went to Vanderbilt and then went on to become the founding architect of the core curriculum of the University of Dallas, which is my alma mater, I just can't thank the University of Dallas enough for the type of formation that I've received there. Okay, so Dr. Cowan tells us, what do we want to look at specifically? What's the sliver I want to look at in classical literature? So remember, classical antiquity, 8th century BC, roughly Homer to the decline of the Roman Empire, 5th century AD. I want to hone in on one particular part of classical literature, which is its conception of the feminine. Its conception of the feminine. Dr. Cowan says that there's something in the poetic universe symbolized by the feminine. Some law, some grace, something symbolized by woman that points to a law beyond strict logic, strict rationality, right, which is represented by the masculine. So woman is that law beyond. Think of Helen of Troy. Think of Dido. Think of Eve, right? They symbolize it, right? Helen, she has this dignity and this beauty that causes a fearful 10-year war and the fall of a city. So what are these women? They're almost sacred figures unto themselves. And in classical literature, what else do we see about women? They're tied up with knowledge. Women are tied up with knowledge. Who do you think of? Perhaps Pandora and her box. Eve and the tree of knowledge. And, of course, Athena, the goddess of wisdom and the teacher of heroes. So because it is women who are tied up with knowledge, it is women who have in society, in culture, the role of education, right? Education is a feminine task, this bestowing of wisdom, enculturating the young into the community, right? Inspiring hearts into the truth. Remember, she realizes that her son is using profane or foul words and she corrects him gently, or that her daughter is tending to gossip, right? And she gently corrects that. Do you remember the saying? Perhaps you've heard it. The hand that rocks the cradle rules the world, because she's forming their hearts into the true. So I think there's something mysterious here, right? That women are entrusted with wisdom. The beautiful communicates the true. So the feminine heralds this mysterious grandeur that is our destiny. Now, in the realm of love, woman and man are connected to two different aspects. Women are connected to agape love, right? Agape. So that, which is actually divine love, right? So what does she do? She receives the man and she bestows love upon him. Women are connected to agape love. Men, on the other hand, are connected to erotic love. Erotic, eros, romantic love, right? So this seeking, right? It's the man who goes out on the quest. He's seeking love, seeking love. And notice, what's woman going to do? Woman is going to bestow. She's going to receive him and bestow love on him. And what have you noticed with, what do you notice within the universe of classical literature? That when a woman, instead of being in the agapic mode, is in the erotic mode, she's in trouble. Who are women in classical literature that we find in the erotic or seeking mode? Well, one is Clytemnestra, right, in the Oresteia. So remember, she commits adultery with, is it Agamemnon? And so she's trying to plot to kill her husband, right? So because they have this adulterous affair. And then who's another woman? Phaedra, right? Phaedra, she falls in love. She's the wife of Theseus, but she falls in love with this young Hippolytus. Do you know Potiphar's wife from the Old Testament? Right? She's like, she's really creepy. Right? She's this older woman and she's like in love with Joseph, who's like 10 years younger, and she grabs him, right? Oh, that's crazy, creepy, old creep, all this stuff. So Potiphar's wife is like another Phaedra. And then also one of the most horrifying women ever in the seeking mode, Medea, right? Who butchers her sons and feeds them to Jason in revenge as his dinner, right? So, yes, these women in the erotic mode, something's wrong, right? They're in trouble. So this is the way the classical authors try to show us something about woman. Now, let's go then to the medieval world. Let's go to the medieval world. And the one particular sliver of the medieval world I'd like to look at is through the eyes of an author, Denis de Rougemont. He writes this book called Love in the Western World. And what he points out, the sliver I want to look at, is medieval romances. And what he suggests, and actually proves quite convincingly in this book, is that medieval romances somehow went astray in their glorification, their exaltation of passion. Okay, but first we have to just understand what he means by passion. So there's what's called sensuality, right? And sensuality, there's nothing wrong with sensuality. Sensuality is normal, it's of the body, it's part of genuine love, but it's also in need of purification, right? It needs to be purified of its selfishness. So sensuality, because we're incarnate beings, right? We're incarnate spirits, we're made for love through the body. Right? And this is what John Paul, his theology of the body is all about. But the purification is needed because of the encroachment of sin and selfishness. So the Christian ideal of marital sexual love is, or the purified version of sensuality would be, you would say that it would be these selfless sexual acts that are characterized by reverence and modesty. So sensuality isn't, there's not anything wrong with it, right? It's the way God created us. It's good. Passion, on the other hand, when Denis de Rougemont speaks about passion, he's not speaking about lust, but lust is definitely a part of it. He speaks of passion as something we're all familiar with. Being in love with being in love, right? Being in love with being in love. So it's this dream of being a god unto oneself. And Denis de Rougemont actually calls it seeking death. Now, he's made a lot of skips there, right? But he's definitely right. This is seeking death. But just think, pause for a second. Okay, now I come from Nashville. I just came from Nashville, Music City. Right, the heart of country music. Don't just think about country music. Think about all popular music that's out there right now. How much of popular music, what percent of popular music is about falling in love and being in love? Give me a percentage, anybody.
70.
Anybody else? 90. Oh, yeah. Right. Okay, right. There's a huge, yes, it's definitely the majority, right, is about falling in love and being in love. And then what percentage of music is actually about, like, faithfulness and sticking it out? And this is crummy and I'm suffering, but honey, you're worth it. And I'm growing because I'm a jerk and I need to grow. It ain't, not a lot of music, right? But, okay, so there's something there, right? So it's really interesting. You think about this kind of formation, right? You think about the chivalric romances. You know, one of the absolute best homilies I've ever heard in my entire life was preached by a Jesuit who was our chaplain. And he worked side by side with Ratzinger in the CDF. They worked together. And so he was kind of like in retirement, and he was being our chaplain, and we were totally spoiled by his amazing homilies. One particular homily struck me. And this is what Father John Rock said. He said, "The love of Tristan and Isolde, the love of Lancelot and Guinevere, the love of Romeo and Juliet says to the world, be damned. The love of Tristan and Isolde, the love of Lancelot and Guinevere, the love of Romeo and Juliet says to the world, be damned." What does that mean? Their love says, I don't care about you. I care about me, right? The other becomes a mere means by which they worship themselves. That's what we see in good literature. Okay, but this is our problem, I think, in the American system, if I may critique it shortly. That we read Romeo and Juliet when we're like in seventh grade, right? And we have no idea what's going on. All we know, if we're reading it at all, is like, these people are really annoying. Okay, first, I don't understand how they're using weird words, and they're super annoying. If you were annoyed by Romeo and Juliet, great job, because that was part of Shakespeare's purpose. Okay, do you know, I'm just going to take one aspect. The word to, T-O-O, Shakespeare purposely uses it many, 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 many times. He uses it at least 57 times. Now, I need to go back and double check, because I just Googled it, and that's what Sporkle said, 57 times. Okay, so 57 times. Let me give you a couple of examples. Because why is he using the word to, T-O-O? He's trying to show us that Romeo and Juliet are just little annoying puppies, and they're really worshiping themselves through the other person. They're not really in love with each other. Remember, Romeo is trying to go to that party because he's in love with Rosalind, but then all of a sudden he sees Juliet, and now he's in love with her. Okay, so we should be suspicious. Okay, so he's trying to show us the love between Romeo and Juliet is excessive. It's off. It's immature. Something's wrong. So I'm going to read you a couple lines. Romeo says, "Is love a tender thing? It is too rough, too rude, too boisterous. It pricks like thorns." Juliet says, "It is too rash, too unadvised, too sudden, too like lightning." And then, at the end of the play, when they finally both die, thanks be to God, Friar Lawrence, right, who represents God, preaches the final homily, right? What have these two people taught us? This is what Friar Lawrence says. "These violent delights have violent ends, and in their triumph die, like fire and powder, which as they kiss, consume. The sweetest honey is loathsome in its own deliciousness, and the taste confounds the appetite. Therefore, love moderately, long love doth so. Too swift arrives as tardy as too slow." Right? That's good literature. Another piece of, okay, this is a little bit harder to find. But remember the Arthurian legends? And the Arthurian legends were taken in many different directions. And some of those directions were bad, right? The love of Lancelot and Guinevere says to the world, be damned, in some of these versions. I think this gives us a reason to be proud of America. So in 1960, I don't know if you've heard of it, Lerner and Lowe put on this musical called Camelot, based on T.H. White's Once and Future King. And so you know the basic story, right? King Arthur is married to Guinevere, Queen Guinevere, but the head knight of the Round Table, right, Lancelot, has an adulterous affair with Guinevere. Okay? And that's just the basic story that is taken in a million different directions. Now, how did the American version in 1960 take flesh? Well, this is what's so cool. Guinevere falls in love with Lancelot, and she, there's this song that's called I Love, so this is Julie Andrews, okay? So she's talking about the end, right? This is at the end, after the whole thing is over. She talks about going back, thinking about the time she was first falling in love with Lancelot, okay? And she's going back after they've received their punishment at the end, okay? And so the song is something like, I loved you once in silence and misery was all I knew, right? And so the whole thing is like, trying so to keep my love from showing, all the while not knowing you loved me too. Yes, you loved me in lonesome silence. Your heart was filled with dark despair, et cetera, et cetera. So she goes on. And then one day, we flung wide our prison doors and every word of love was spoken. Okay, so then they reveal to each other this illicit love that they have for each other. And you know what the refrain of the song is? And now, there's twice as much grief, twice the strain for us, twice the despair, twice the pain for us as we had known before. Right? Because Lancelot, I don't know if he gets the death penalty. I forgot what happens to Lancelot at the end of Camelot. And then Guinevere. They all get the same after a while. Guinevere is sent into a convent or something to do penance, right? So this is beautiful, right? Sin doesn't pay. It actually makes you more miserable in the end. So if you look at the types of literature that we have today in our movies, in our music, etc., in television shows, Augustine would call this a formation in loving what does not satisfy. Right, just following our passions, it doesn't satisfy. This exaltation of passion is really seeking death. I love the way Joseph Pierce, in a sense, puts de Rougemont's observations, you could say. Think about this, that there's two types of literature, okay? But it goes into subtypes, okay? So there's good literature. Good literature meaning well-executed literature, right? It's entertaining, it's appealing, it draws you in, right? It works your imagination. That's good literature, well executed. Then there's bad literature. Nice try, poorly executed, not so good, not very creative. Okay, we're not really worried about bad literature because it's not going to survive. We're worried about good literature. I mean, good literature, but there's subcategories under good literature. Because under good literature, there's good literature. In other words, good literature that has good morals, like you just saw with Shakespeare, like you saw with Lerner and Lowe's Camelot. But then there's good, bad literature. It's well executed, but the morals are terrible. It teaches you to love what is bad. And I remember a long time ago, a young girl came up to me and she said, "Sister, I know what you're talking about. I don't know if any of you have watched The Notebook or read The Notebook, right? But it's this glorification of passion. And all of a sudden, everything they do is okay because they love each other. But it's not okay, right? They fornicate, they do all these other bad things, but it's glamorized, right? So that's what's dangerous. Good literature is good, but good, bad literature is dangerous. Now there's bad literature that's got good morals. Well, sorry, you're not gonna last. Nice try. Okay, and then there's bad literature, which nobody should read. Okay, so there you have it. But I think it's really helpful. Think about the type of literature that you read. Think of the movies, think of the music, think of all of that. So yeah, good art. Okay, so let's go back to what Father Rock was saying. The love of Tristan and Isolde, the love of Lancelot and Guinevere, the love of Romeo and Juliet says to the world, be damned. What does that mean? I don't care about you. I only care about me. Where do we fail morally? What is a moral failure? A moral failure is a rejection of reality, right? And this is something very scary because of technology, people have a more and more tenuous connection to reality, right? They try to not live in reality, but reality is actually where we need to live. Reality is what's really going to form us as human beings. What is the most fundamental reality for each one of us in this room? The most fundamental reality for each one of us in this room is that we are born into a set of relationships to which we are bound, right? We have a mother and a grandmother, a father and a grandfather, two sets of each, right? We have brothers and sisters. That's where we are first bound. That's where our first loyalties lie. This is the beauty of the communion for which we're created. Okay, so what's the second part of failing morally then? The rejection of reality. Second, how does it play itself out? The refusal of community, the refusal of relationship. So the rejection of family, the rejection of social responsibility. Okay, I think this is very interesting. Oh, you guys probably know the statistics better than I do. So the U.S. Census Bureau came out recently. Okay, I don't know if you guys knew this. Some people don't know this. But in the 1930s, cohabitation was illegal. You gotta love America, right? That was America we love. Cohabitation was illegal. It says something, right? It says something about what we value with family. Now there are over 20 million people cohabitating. Over 20 million, okay? And then the U.S. Census Bureau in 2022, they found out how many U.S. households, what percentage of U.S. households are a married couple and their children. What percentage? Anybody? What percentage of, in 2022, U.S. households are a married couple and their children?
Less than half.
What?
Less than half.
Yes. Keep going.
35.
Less than 35?
20.
Less than 50? Less than 25. 17%. Of American households are a man and a woman married to each other and their children. You see how important the moral imagination is? This idea of what is reality? Reality is communion. Reality is relationship. Reality is family. Reality is social responsibility. And now divorce, I mean, people say, we don't have to worry about divorce if we don't get married, right? We just cohabit. So, but this is interesting. Because of what's happening in society, you have these fascinating studies that are going on. So some of us, I mean, come on, sisters, we wish we were just born perfect. Let's name her Sister Jane. Okay, no. It's, you know, we come from dysfunctional families, too. We all come from the dysfunctional family of Adam and Eve, right? Priests, sisters, all of us, married people. So a sister friend of mine, because she knows my parents are divorced, her parents are divorced, she recommended a book to me called Primal Loss, which is amazing, okay? It's basically adult children of divorced parents telling the stories of their lives, like how this has affected my ability to make a commitment, my ability to have trust in a relationship, my ability, okay, which is really amazing. So basically, an adult man tells this story about when he was a child. And he's talking about his father walking out on his mom and his brothers and sisters. And he says, it's kind of like we were on this like plane ride. We were on a family plane ride and we had our own private jet. And all of us are in the back and dad's flying the plane and mom's co-piloting. And like somehow in the middle, you know, we're playing a game in the back and dad gets up. He leaves the pilot seat. He gets one of the parachutes, opens the side door, messing up the cabin pressure for all of us, and just jumps out and says, see you later. Good luck. Right? So this is the havoc that is being wreaked in families. Right? These people are now adults. Another very stark image was given by a priest at the World Meeting of Families in 2014. And I can't remember if his parents are divorced, but he was speaking about what divorce does, what's happened. This was his characterization of what's happening in divorce, right? From his own personal experience, but also from his pastoral experience. He said, this is what happens in divorce. It's like the parents, they take the cross. Remember, all vocations lead to the cross. There's not a cross in your vocation, you're doing something wrong. So he said, this is what it's like. It's like they take the cross and they put it on the kitchen table. Now the kids have to come and pick it up. Right? So I think there's something really true here. So this rejection of morality, this rejection of societal ethics is something destructive. Because really, where does human fulfillment come? Well, if you read the classics, you'll know. It comes from, we find fulfillment in being faithful to our commitments. Because that's what is noble. That's what is honorable. That is what is just. That is what is pure. That is what is heroic. So to be faithful in the struggle, not to just leave the struggle, right? That's what's so, it's so sad that we're being told freedom isn't leaving the struggle. And it's not. Okay, this brings us then finally to this modern piece of literature, Tolstoy's Anna Karenina, right? We looked at classical literature. We saw the portrait of the feminine. We looked at medieval literature, specifically where the medievals went wrong, right, in the chivalric romances. And now I'd like us to look at Tolstoy's Anna Karenina. And what I want to do is just take you through, first, the structure of the novel. So Tolstoy has an artistic vision that is deeply moral. He's different from Dostoevsky, right? Dostoevsky is all metaphysical. Tolstoy is all moral. And what is the logos, what is the ethos at the foundation or at the heart of this novel? It's this. Marriage is the foundation of society. Think about that. Marriage is the foundation of society. So faithfulness in marriage upholds society. It's absolutely necessary for a healthy society. In other words, Tolstoy is trying to say that there is something larger than ourselves that is at stake in marriage. There's something larger than ourselves that is at stake in marriage. And that something is sacred. That's the logos and the ethos. Marriage is the foundation of society. There's something larger at stake in marriage. Something larger than ourselves that is at stake. And that something is sacred. That's the logos and the ethos. What is the logos in terms of the structure? Well, the structure basically, so that's the foundational idea, the foundational principle, is that there are two marriages that run parallel to each other. In fact, he almost called the novel A Tale of Two Marriages. But because Tolstoy is not just brilliant, but a genius, the two stories don't just run parallel to each other. The two stories are actually like this. One story is a comedy, a movement upwards, right? Not comedy in the sense of haha, but the comedy in the classical sense of a movement upward. And then the other story is a tragedy, a movement downward, right? So he's got this amazing construction in the novel. So there are two protagonists, right? A protagonist for the comedy and a protagonist for the tragedy. The novel itself is named after the protagonist of the tragedy, Anna Karenina. So let's look at the protagonist of the comedy. His name is Konstantin Levin, okay? And what makes it a comedy is what the protagonist is seeking. What is Levin seeking? Okay, first let's just talk about who Levin is. So Levin is a wealthy aristocratic man, right? He's handsome and he's virtuous and he is also kind of socially awkward, which I think makes him more charming personally. But he also he's concerned with the highest things. He's also concerned with the plight of the peasant, right? He works alongside of them so he can figure out how can I help to improve their place in society. So what is Levin seeking? He is seeking truth and virtue. He's seeking truth and virtue. So he wants to know what is true, what is just. And he's aware of the discrepancies between the ideal and the real, but he's willing to accept them. And he also seeks to live by the moral laws of earthly society. So for the moral laws of earthly society, what is the symbol? Marriage is their symbol. And he recognizes that by following these laws of earthly society, that's how I'm going to find fulfillment. But this is the interesting thing. And I think this is what's so true to life. Levin's way is a via negativa. He seems to have less and less, right? Here's this virtuous man seeking truth and to build virtue within himself. And yet he seems to have less and less, right? He finally gets the courage up to ask this beautiful Katerina to marry him, right, Kitty? And she refuses him. And so, he has to go back out into the farm. He's ashamed, right? He doesn't live for himself. He lives for others. But he seems to have less and less. So his looks on the outside to Levin himself, it feels like a movement downward. But it's not. It's actually a movement upward, right? His is the comedy. And his life ends crowned with faith and joy. Okay, what's the other one? What's the tragedy? The second protagonist is Anna Karenina. And what is Anna Karenina? Well, she is this beautiful. She, Louise Cowan calls her the queen of St. Petersburg society, right? She's beautiful. She's well-mannered. She has the highest upstanding morals, right? People come to her for advice. So she is the protagonist of the tragedy. And what is Anna seeking? Innocently enough, she's seeking happiness. But happiness as self-fulfillment at all costs. So Anna, we see, becomes more and more concerned with her own reality, her world. And what do we see happen to her? She starts grasping at love. Uh-oh. This is a woman in the erotic mode, right? And so this is where Tolstoy is leaning upon the classical tradition, that a woman in the erotic mode is going to be in trouble. She's grasping at love. She's making a choice for self, right? She's going to leave her husband to go after, to run away with this military man. She seems to have more and more, but actually she has less and less. Hers is this movement downward, right? Hers is the tragedy. Okay, so let's just say a little bit more about Anna Karenina. So we already said she's a noble woman, a happy woman, beautiful, the queen of St. Petersburg society. She helps others. She's wise. She's a trusted counselor. In fact, the book opens. She's giving advice to a woman whose husband has committed adultery on her. And so she's trying to uphold. She says, no, you have to forgive him. For the sake of the children, for the sake of your marriage, you have to forgive him. Right? So you see this. You see Anna's beautiful integrity. And Anna is happily married. Okay, this is where all the movies, of course, go wrong. I have not seen a single movie that paints Karenin properly. Karenin is really a wonderful husband. He's, now true, he's a bureaucrat, he's a successful businessman, but he's a good man. He does have a piety for appearances that's appropriate, right? There's nothing wrong with that. And you have this sense that Karenin would never commit adultery, right? You there's this firm, upright, virtuous man. They have a good marriage. They have a happy marriage. They have an intimate life that they share together. And I will actually hopefully show you in the novel, you'll see this, very clear pieces of evidence. If you read it and look through it, you'll see that they had a happy marriage. So there's no evidence whatsoever in the novel that she had not been happy in her marriage with Karenin, right? So what the bad movies do is basically they try to say, oh, Anna, she's so passionate and beautiful, and her husband was just cold and distant. So she needed to find somebody equally passionate and right? Which is fine. That's really, oh, that's a really deep reason. Okay, so anyway, so if you look at the real book, you'll see that there's no evidence in the novel that they were not happy. So what happens? A shameless military man, well named Count Vronsky comes from out of town, and he sees Anna. And at first he was courting Kitty, and then he shamelessly stops courting Kitty, which is bad manners, okay? Immoral, right? He pulls the heartstrings of this little teenage girl, and then he goes to run after this married woman. Okay, that's what he starts doing, right? So he's taken by her beauty. He's crazy about her. He can't stop thinking about her. And he keeps pursuing her. Persistently, persistently, persistently. He's romantic, he's charming, and he's got the uniform, right? So, okay, so at first, you see Anna's character, right? She resists strongly. Oh, I wish I had time to read this to you. But there's this point where she's on the train, okay? Because she needs to get out of town because Vronsky keeps trying to pursue her, keeps trying to pursue her, and she feels like, you know, this is what they say in literature, basically. Almost all literature says this. The source of woman's downfall, vanity. Right? So it's appealing to her vanity, and she starts to like kind of start falling for Vronsky. So she's like, I gotta leave town, which is smart, right? Flight. So she starts leaving town. She gets on the train, and who's on the train? Vronsky's on the train. And she's like surprised. She's also flattered, right? So Tolstoy beautifully paints this inner struggle. And so she says, but why are you here? And he says, to be where you are. And she says, stop, this is wrong. If you are a good man, forget what you have said to me, even as I shall forget it. And he says, I cannot forget, nor will I ever forget. Okay, so this is bad. He's not a good man. Okay, it's made very clear. He's not a good man. Now, what then is this temptation that Anna is beginning to give into? What's the misleading insight? What is the foundation of every single temptation we will ever face? You shall be as God, right? We know this from classical literature. What is the downfall of every tragic hero? Hubris. But remember, hubris takes different forms. So hubris for man is different from hubris in woman, right? So hubris in man is, he's going to be a god. How? Some dream of power, right? More than is really possible. Think about Icarus, right? Flying, wanting to fly toward the sun. Think of Napoleon and Caesar and, yeah, all those guys. Right? So this hubris, this dream of more power than is really possible. But then with a woman, hubris takes a different form. You will be as a goddess. And I love the way Louise Callan puts it. She says, what is the temptation for every woman? What is it that she desires? To be the center of adoring worship, right? Which is really cool. I think if you're a woman, you're like, okay, that's right. Right, so to be the center, I know you guys can't relate to that because you're into the power, but we are into the adoring worship. Okay, so this is what every woman wants, to be the center, I mean, fallen woman, wants to be the center of adoring worship. And what is making this dream begin to look like a reality for Anna? Vronsky's passion, right? And this is what she cannot resist. And so she begins seeking death. So here's the famous scene that I will read to you because it's just too good not to read. Okay, so this is what happens. What happens is, okay, this is how it works in St. Petersburg society. You're an aristocrat, you gotta go to all these parties because this is where you know, I don't know what you guys call it on Capitol Hill, but you know, you do that stuff. You like gotta work the crowd, you gotta get around, right? So basically you go from this crowd, you go to this crowd, and then you go to this crowd, and then you go to this, right? You just make your way around, okay? So especially if you're a married woman or a married man, you need to keep moving, okay? So at this one particular party, after Vronsky has been chasing after Anna 20 million times, she is finally just gonna like surrender, okay? Which is bad. Because this is what she wants. I mean, you know that. Okay, so she and Count Vronsky are in this little table right here. And Karenin comes later, right? Because they always disagree to meet there because he's coming from work, all this kind of stuff. So they're there, and then Karenin comes by, okay? And then Karenin moves on. And then Karenin moves on. And as he moves on, like, the groups are talking about, hey, Anna has been at that whole table. She's been at Count Vronsky. She's been with Count Vronsky the whole night. She has not moved. What's going on, right? And then he goes to another. They're saying this, but they be quiet as soon as he gets there, right? So, So this is socially unacceptable. There's some kind of there's a moral transgression going on here because she's not respecting the laws of society which protect marriages, right? And so Karenin leaves early, and Anna comes in, and so now I'm picking up here where Tolstoy is painting the portrait for you of what happens. Okay, so what usually happens after a party, you know, husbands and wives do this. They debrief. Oh, did you hear about such and such and such? Oh, that was really interesting about such, right? So usually Anna is like putting her hair down and, you know, undressing and all that stuff while they're debriefing about what happened at the party, okay? So that's what they're going to, that's their usual thing that they do, okay? So now Karenin's already home and Anna comes in. And I want you to listen for the darkness. Listen for the darkness, listen for the devil. Anna came in with her head bent, playing with the tassels of her hood. Her face was glowing with a vivid glow, but this glow was not one of joyousness. It recalled the fearful glow of a conflagration in the midst of a dark night. On seeing her husband, Anna raised her head and smiled, as though she had just waked up. "You're not in bed? What a miracle," she said, throwing off her hood. And without stopping, she went on into the dressing room and said, "It's late, Alexei Alexandrovich," from behind the door. "Anna, I must have a talk with you." "With me," she said, wonderingly. She came out from the door and looked at him. "Why, what is it? What about?" she asked, sitting down. "Well, let's talk if it's so necessary, but it would be better to go to sleep." Anna was saying whatever came to her tongue, and marveled, hearing herself, at her own capacity for lying. How simple and natural were her words, and how likely that she was simply sleepy. She felt herself clad in an impenetrable armor of falsehood. She felt that some unseen force had come to her aid and was supporting her. Right? This is the devil. It's the devil supporting her. "Anna, I must warn you," Karenin began. "Warn me," she said, "of what?" She looked at him so simply, so brightly, that anyone who did not know her as her husband knew her could not have noticed anything unnatural, either in the sound or the sense of her words. But to him, knowing her, knowing that whenever he went to bed 5 minutes later than usual, she noticed it and asked him the reason. To him, knowing that every joy, every pleasure and pain she felt, she communicated to him at once. To him, it meant a great deal to see now she did not care to notice his state of mind, that she did not care to say a word about herself. He saw that the inmost recesses of her soul, which had hitherto lain open before him, were now closed against him. More than that, he saw from her tone that she was not even perturbed at that, but seemed to be saying straightforwardly to him, "Yes, it is closed now, which is as it should be and will be so in the future." Now he experienced a feeling such as a man might have who, returning home, finds his own house locked up. Right, so this is the first step to sin, is that we shut the door on relationship, right? And you can see from this passage how beautiful a relationship they did have, right? That they knew what was going on with each other. But this is the beginning, right? To sin, we have to cut off relationship. So shortly after this scene, what happens? Bam, the adulteress Vronsky and Anna commit adultery, right? And they begin and continue this adulterous relationship. Now, this is the most famous scene in the whole book. I'm sorry I'm giving you all these spoilers, okay? This is the most famous scene in the whole book. But it captures perfectly what is happening, okay? So Vronsky, this military man, he's actually very good at what he does, and he is a famed horse rider. And there is this big horse race. So just like football is big for us, of course, right? This was the big thing that they did. So this horse race is the big deal. So what's going to happen? Okay, so you guys are in the audience, right? You have like these bleachers, these stands, and the horse race is going on out there. Okay, so they can see like, let's start it over here. So it starts over here. There's the first hurdle that the horse has to jump, and then you have to go here and go through this, da-da-da-da, and it goes all the way around, right? So the people in the stands can see the whole horse race and see who's winning. Okay, now, Count Vronsky, he is very proud. He's one of the favored to win this race, and then one of his arch enemies is also favored to win the race. So it's like, we know that even though there's all these other guys, these are the two guys, okay? So, Vronsky, he's got a gorgeous horse. It's this beautiful, white, majestic, spirited horse whose name is Frou Frou, okay? That's the name of his horse. Now, there's a reason for this. Tolstoy's, he's a genius. Okay, so, they're at the gate, right? Snarling at each other. Vronsky and his competitor. And so then they're off because they're going. Vronsky's in the lead, right? Crowd goes wild. Important. Anna is there with Karenin and they're watching. Okay, so she's got the binoculars, right? And so like Karenin's noticing she's leaning forward an awful lot, right? Because he doesn't know about all this stuff, right? So Anna's like really concerned. She's watching. She's like excited, okay? And Karenin's sitting next to her. Okay, so Vronsky's in the lead. And then the first hurdle. Frou Frou, gorgeous, amazing horse, clears it so beautifully, right? Like the crowd is delighted when they see this beautiful leap in the air, easily clears that first hurdle. Now, Vronsky is so full of himself. He's like, I'm awesome, okay? And so what does he do? He makes a fatal riding error. Now, Tolstoy is doing this to show us the lack of integrity in Vronsky. He lacks integrity. And this is why he makes the fatal riding error, which is, those of you who are familiar with horse racing, is as he is landing on the horse, remember you go up with the horse and there's a few seconds where you're off the horse, right? And then the horse lands back down, your body goes back down on the horse, okay? As he lands on the horse's back again, he pulls the reins back, which means he's broken the horse's neck, okay? So the horse, Frou Frou, this beautiful horse, falls to the ground and is writhing in pain, okay? And then he's like, Frou Frou, get up, Frou Frou, get up. Meanwhile, his arch enemy, ha, 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 right, snarls at him and says something, right? So he's pleading, Frou Frou, get up, Frou-Frou cannot get up because he has broken Frou-Frou's neck. What does Vronsky do when Frou-Frou doesn't get up? He starts kicking the horse. He starts kicking his beloved Frou-Frou. This is my question to you. Who does Frou-Frou represent? Who is Frou-Frou represent?
Jesus.
Anna, right? Anna is this beautiful, spirited, majestic racehorse. Tolstoy, in his brilliance, what does he use for adultery? This base image, right? He rides her. Because he tries to capture for us, but very elegantly, right? The baseness of adultery. That this is a perverse and wicked man, this Count Vronsky. And this image of Vronsky kicking the beloved, the beautiful, majestic horse, right, is forever etched in our minds. And what does it fill us with? Repulsion. This hatred for what is evil, right? Because this man is less than a man. He is no man. He is a selfish man, right? Who destroys what is beautiful and what is good and what was pure. Okay, so meanwhile, what happens? Anna is going hysterical because she thinks, is he dead? Like, did Vronsky die, right? Because a horse fell on him partially. And so she's going insane. And Karenin is saying, this is not appropriate. You need to calm down because everyone's looking at you. And he's, you know, and so he has to take her to the carriage and he has to send her home. As he takes her to the carriage, she says to him, because she's hysterical, she says to Karenin, she looks him in the eye and she says, I love Count Vronsky. I am his mistress, right? And so Karenin, because he does what is appropriate, he has to break off the relationship with her. So they have to legally separate, okay? So Anna has an 8-year-old son, Seryosha, who she says she loves, right? But by her actions, she is saying to him, be damned, right? That's what she's saying to Karenin. That's what she's saying to Seryosha. So Anna and Vronsky, they go off to their love, they go have this love nest. Poor Karenin is trying to scrape things together to try to raise Seryosha, and he feels obviously scandalized, betrayed, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so that's the image that we have of Vronsky. I want to give you an image too that is less famous, but I don't know, beautiful. It's this image of Levin. Remember Levin, the protagonist of the comedy? So Levin, remember, he's socially awkward, but he's actually super strong, and he was actually at one point the skating champion of his village, okay? But he's been off at the farm doing all these things with the peasants, and so, oh yeah, that's another thing I love about Levin. When I was reading the book again a second time, I started reading a third time, but you see, like, the way that Tolstoy depicts Levin, right? He's got the rain falling on his face. His hand is in the soil, right? He's like, his eyes are taking in the light. Like, it's like he's in love with reality as God created it. So Levin is like, he's out skating at the skating rink, and Kitty is there, okay? Kitty, who he wants to marry, okay? And so, you know, Kitty's there and she's been skating, and so she's all, her cheeks are all red, and her eyes are shining in the sunlight, and, you know, she's got her little muff on, and she's like just standing there taking a break, okay? And so Levin, it's been a while since he's been back on the skating rink. And these younger guys, like, there are new skating champions, they're doing this thing where they, like, pop down the steps of the skating rink. And then they, like, do this, like, triple twist thing. And then, you know how they do, you know how they do those things. Okay, you guys have watched the Olympics. Okay, so this is what Levin is planning to do. And his friend is like, you can't do it without practicing. But all too late, because Levin's already taken off, because this is his chance, because Kitty is right there, okay? So he does it. He goes hop, 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 and then he stumbles just a little bit. He catches himself. He does a triple twist thing, and he goes like this, skates around. And he turns around, okay? And what does he see? He looks at Kitty, and she is smiling, right? Smiling this beautiful, gorgeous smile. And Levin is filled with joy. You see this? The physical integrity, the moral integrity, right? He stumbles a little bit because he's socially awkward, But why is he so happy to see Kitty smile? You know, I think it's something that young men experience when you take a young woman, when you have the courage to take a young woman out on a date, right? And you say something funny, and she's genuinely delighted, right? It's not just like, right? It's like she's genuinely delighted. Why does it make you so happy when she smiles, when she laughs? Same reason for Levin. He gets this sense, I can provide for her. I can make her happy. Right? And so this is the beautiful portrait that we have of Levin, which makes us love the good. Right? We see that Levin is the hero. Okay, how does Vronsky, okay, these are all spoilers. Vronsky, how does Vronsky end the novel? Again, Tolstoy's genius with a toothache, right? An abscess. Because, you know, it captures the indignity, right? The emptiness of this man, his weakness, his inactivity, right? He isn't anything but a hero. He looks like a hero, but he's not a hero. Levin doesn't look like a hero, but he is a hero. Okay, how does Anna end? I think you could guess, right? He placed her among the great suicides, like Madame Bovary. She throws herself in front of a train. And this is interesting. Vronsky's mother says, Vronsky's mother, the mother who raised Vronsky, has the nerve to say, her life was as vulgar as her death, or her death was as vulgar as her life. So this is the way Louise Cowan puts it. In her, Anna's, in her turning away from those inviolable, unwritten laws to finding happiness, Anna finds instead absolute nothingness. In her turning away from those inviolable, unwritten laws to finding happiness, Anna finds instead absolute nothingness. So that's what an adulteress can teach us about. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith. And it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.